3-7 through 4-11.
Therefore, just as the Holy Spirit says, today if you hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me, as in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tried me by testing me, and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore I was angry with this generation and said, they always go astray in their heart, as they did not know my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Take care, brethren, lest there should be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart, and falling away from the living God. But encourage one another day after day, as long as it's still called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ, if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance firm until the end. While it is said today, if you hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me. For who provoked Him when they had heard? Indeed, did not all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was He angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did He swear that they should not enter His rest, but to those who were disobedient? And so we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. Therefore, let us fear lest, while a promise remains of entering His rest, any one of you should seem to have come short of it. For indeed we have had good news preached to us, just as they also. But the word they heard did not profit them, because it was not united by faith in those who heard. For we who have believed enter that rest, just as He has said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although His works were finished from the foundation of the world. For He has thus said somewhere concerning the seventh day, and God rested on the seventh day from all His works. And again in this passage, they shall not enter my rest. Since therefore it remains for some time to enter it, try that again. Since therefore it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly had good news preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience, He again fixes a certain day today, saying through David, after so long a time, just as been said before, today if you hear His voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, He would not have spoken of another day after that. There remains therefore a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered His rest has himself also rested from his works, as God did from His. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall through following the same example of disobedience.
All right. So if you remember from 2 weeks ago, in 3:7 through following, what you basically have is, well, I mean, we could walk all the way back to the beginning of this book and how it traces through, but remember that the theme of faith really gets picked up on in chapter 3, tying off of 2:17, in that Christ was a merciful and faithful high priest. And so 3:1 through 6 was how Christ was faithful, and then tying off of Christ's faithfulness is the call to us to be faithful. And you remember, throughout this whole section, faith keeps running in and through here. Really, one of the main verses of that whole section is verse 12. Take care, brethren, that there not be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief, literally. It's an evil heart characterized by unbelief. The heart is evil because it's unbelieving, because it's not faithful. And remember, those terms, faithful and believing, are so tied together in falling away from the living God. And then verse 19, so we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. And so unbelief, as 19 really sums up everything, is like, so we see, it's just a summary statement. That's how he's summing up everything. They didn't enter because of unbelief. It's an evil heart of unbelief. That's really the crux of the matter. And so really the exhortation is in verses 12 and 13 to take care that we not have a heart of unbelief, and that on the converse, that we encourage one another every day so that we aren't hardened by the deceitfulness of sin, and the need to hold fast to Christ until the end. And so we have the warning of 3:7 through 19. Now, as we turn to chapter 4 then, it really picks up on the same thought, although it's going to change in emphasis slightly. It's still going to be a warning about disbelief. Faith still runs really through this passage, but it's going to get a little bit more of a positive spin to it, because we're going to look not only about the warning of falling, but which is still in there, the warning of not entering the rest, but it's also going to be the positive side of what we're pressing on towards, and that is the promise of God's rest. So we'll see that as we go through. But really, as we start off, remember verses 7 through 11 is Psalm 95. And let me just, I know Doug read it, but let me just read it once more and point out a couple key points that the author is going to pick up on here, because as we move into chapter 4, he's still developing Psalm 95. And so he started off with the warning of Psalm 95, and he's going to draw some implications from it. So he says, that first opening line, today if you hear his voice. And if you remember, this psalm is about the Exodus generation and they're not entering the promised land because they didn't believe the promise. Remember, you know, the Exodus generation standing on the brink of the promised land, the report of the spies comes in, and they don't believe it, and so they don't enter, they don't obey. And so you remember that the psalmist in Psalm 95 is reflecting back on the Exodus generation, and he's exhorting his hearers in his day, which is hundreds of years later after the Exodus generation. And this psalmist exhorts his hearers with, you know, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. And so this is the words of the psalmist, not necessarily the words of Moses. And so the psalmist is kind of applying the situation that was true of the Exodus to his own hearers and saying, don't be like the Exodus generation. And so the author of Hebrews is then going to pick up on what the psalmist did and say basically the same thing. In other words, if the psalmist can exhort the hearers of his day not to be like the Exodus generation, then the author of Hebrews can do the same. And so he's kind of picking up on what the psalmist is doing. So hopefully that gives you at least a little bit of a reminder of where we were, and we'll dive back into the details of it as he continues to re-quote Psalm 95 in chapter 4 and develop his argument from it. And so as you dive into chapter 4, therefore, let us fear, if while a promise remains of entering his rest, any one of you may seem to have come short of it. And so right off the bat, it's obvious, just continuing exhortation, continuing warning, let us fear. Obviously, the idea of fear is to be fearful of, you know, it's a real possibility that you could do what the Exodus generation did. And at the same time, the book of Hebrews, while it's so full of warnings, at the same time we see he's addressing believers, and he's not saying you are going to fall like the Exodus generation does, but he does warn them not to. And so you kind of have a little bit of tension there in that there's a real possibility that they could fall like the Exodus generation did, yet at the same time he encourages them that he's convinced that they're going to press on. But these warnings are real warnings. And so let us fear, while a promise remains of entering his rest, any one of you may seem to have come short of it. In other words, you know, there's this promise. You're like the Exodus generation. The Exodus generation had this promise. That's why they call it the promised land, right? They had the promise of entering in the land. And so the readers of this day and in the psalmist day had this promise. And he's going to develop what that promise is and how it flows out of the text. But there's this promise that we have, and we're standing on the brink of promise, as it were, you know, and we're looking forward to that promise. And the danger is that you fall short of it. You know, you think about the Exodus generation. They went through so much, right? They went through the Passover. They went through the crossing of the Red Sea. They went through Sinai. You know, they get all the way to the promised land, and what happens? You know, God was patient with them throughout that whole time, but in that final last act of disbelief and disobedience, when they rejected the spies' report, God said, enough, you're not going in. And so it's like they came short, right? They went all that way. They went through so much, but they came short of it. And that's really what that any one of you may seem to have come short of it. It's like you just didn't quite make it to the end. And of course, that is a major emphasis in this book. As pastors pointed out, we've pointed out before, the faith that is real is the faith that endures, right? You go to Hebrews chapter 11, all those men died in faith. They made it to the end. And so you don't, there's the promise, there's that hope that you're looking forward to. Don't stop short of attaining it. Don't stop halfway there, almost all the way there. And we're on that road, if you will. We're all, you know, professing believers. We've made the confession of faith. We're traveling that direction. And so don't stop. It's the message of this book. Hold fast. Don't let go. Don't stop short of it. And so once again, the exhortation, let us fear. And then once again, he's going to develop this. At first, it kind of throws you for a loop. While a promise remains of entering his rest. And I'm going to have to leave that somewhat open for the time being, because at first you don't know where he's going with that. And so he really develops that in the passage of falling. But just let me bring out first of ideas, the idea of promise is central here. It's that God has given us his word. It's hope that he has promised that something good for us in the future. Promises are always future. Promises are so eschatological. You know, this term, which is significant throughout the book of Hebrews, the great and precious promises that we have. We could go to Hebrews 11, I think three or four times this word promises occur. You know, Abraham had the promises, so many promises of faith in the future. And so faith and promises tied together so integrally. And we'll see that kind of develop throughout this book. But there is the promise remaining. And that's another key word. That promise has not, how should I say it? It's not been cut short, and he'll develop that. So I'm going to have to leave it there. But once again, he starts off with this exhortation not to come short, to fear, and to press on.
This is a good point.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, so you've tied it into the context of chapter 3 there. I don't know if I can. Is there any parallel with their rejection in comparison to the potential rejection? Because you said, it's not that he's saying that they have rejected. He's just warning them against the danger of, right?
Right.
So, taking it back to that context, they rejected the word before they entered into the promised land, right?
Exactly.
Is that the parallel?
Yeah, I think
because
so.
Because it's hard, you know, as you think about it in our context, and again, I'm trying to not put it in our context, but just the hearers.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like they were necessarily well, maybe they were. That's what I'm asking. I can see it really clearly in my mind with the Exodus generation, because they were getting ready to enter into the promised land.
Right.
Right? And the spies come back and the whole story. There seems to be kind of a moment of crisis there.
Right.
Whereas, is there any of that going on with the readers of, this letter? There's a crisis in the sense of maybe, but it's not like these guys are getting ready to enter into Palestine at that point in time. So,
yeah, but I would see it in the author of Hebrews' mind. All of us are at that crisis moment. We're in the moment. We're on the brink of promise. We've heard the promises, but we're not entering in. And that's why it's throughout, you know, Hebrews chapter 11, twice it says they did not receive what was promised, but they held on to those promises by faith. And that's so much an emphasis of chapter 11. And so I think to the author of Hebrews, and I remember we spoke on this earlier in this book, and I have to remember where it was precisely, but it's the idea that, you know, the world to come, right? There's this, it's so eschatological. And so it's kind of like the now age and the age to come. It's the fact that now is the time of decision. Now is the time when we can hold fast to Christ. And so in a, especially in light of their situation, in light of the persecution, they were very much at a moment of crisis, in a sense. But I would say the application is, as long as we're living, we're in that moment of crisis.
That's really the question that I was asking. Because with the Exodus generation, there was a very clear, marked time where there was crisis, and they chose wrong.
Right.
He's basically saying that this is the crisis let's not put it that way, but we're at that moment every day.
Right.
Because when he's talking about this rest here, mm-hmm. he's talking future kingdom age, right?
Yep.
So this is a daily kind of reality that we're reminding ourselves of.
I think so, yep. And that's it's so much that I think you've summed it up well. So much of the message of Hebrews, therefore, is every. That's why the everyday encouragement. That's why you need to press on to the end. It's because all of our lives is that battle to hold fast to faith. And so, yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. So, starts off kind of, excuse me, in verse 1 with the exhortation and the warning, which picks up off chapter 3. And now he's going to draw in some of the parallel, which may even answer some of your question better. For indeed, we have had good news preached to us, or even better, gospeled to us, just as they also. But the word they heard did not profit them. And then, this is a very tough textual variant, but probably best, because they were not united in faith in with those who heard. I'll get into that in a second. So, here's the parallel. Indeed, we have had, we are in the state of having the, you know, been gospeled just as they also. And so I would say here, if you look at verse 2 and verse 1, this good news preached to us is equivalent to the promise, right? We've had good news. We have this promise. And in the context of this section, the promise is the promise of rest. And that was really the promise to the Exodus generation, right? The promise of rest in the promised land. And so we've heard this promise, we have this good news, it's been preached to us, we've heard it, and once again, that's such an emphasis of this book as well. God has spoken, are we listening? Have we've heard the message, we've all been recipients of that message, but what was true of the Exodus generation? The word they heard did not profit them. It didn't do them any good, and if nothing else is clear about the remaining of this phrase, the part that's very evident is the fact of faith. It did them no good to have the word preached to them because they had no faith. And once again, faith is at this heart of this section. In other words, you know what? You can have, God can give you, if I put it this way and you understand what I'm saying, God can give as many promises as he wants, they don't do any good if you don't appropriate those promises by faith. Just hearing the promise itself doesn't secure you the promise, if you will. It's kind of like in one ear, out the other, and it doesn't do you any good. God's promises were such that you had to trust them by faith, to stand upon those promises, and to appropriate them by faith. And so that is the parallel with the Exodus generation, right? We've heard the gospel. Granted, the gospel had different content to them than it does to us. You know, their gospel was about the promise of entering the promised land. Ours is about entering, you know, to draw the parallel, the promised land. But it's not the same promised land. But that's the parallel, right? We have this promise of, I'll leave it real broad at this time, eternity with God. All the great promises that we have. And so we have heard these promises. The question is, what do you do with them? And so the issue is, don't be like the Exodus generation. They heard the promises, but it didn't do them any good. It was useless to them because, now, this one is just tough. The reason it didn't do them any good, the word, they heard the word, and it's either because it was not united by faith in those who heard, or because they were not united in faith with those who heard. And so the question is it the word that's being united with faith, or is it the people that are being united with faith? And it's just a really tough call in terms of, is the idea that you're mixing the message with faith? That's how the NASB has it translated, right? You hear, here's the word, the promise, the good news, and you take that and you mix that promise with faith, and they become so united. So really the term is for blended. You know, if you it's the term from a blender. If you put, you know, two ingredients in a blender, they become inseparable because they've been so thoroughly blended together. And so are you taking the word of God with the promise of God and you're blending that with faith so that you can't You can't just hear it and not believe it. It's got to be united. Or is it the people that are uniting together in faith with the message? And so all in all, I think the meaning is about the same, is that I like the analogy of in one ear, out the other. It's got to stick. It's got to be blended together. It's got to be united such that you can't separate the message from faith, or you can't separate the people from faith. It's a tough textual variant that is just really, really tough to land on. But I think the meaning is clear either way, and faith is at the center of it all.
Are you saying when you say it's a tough textual variant, are you just saying...
There's two different manuscripts. Some of them say one way, some of them say another, and it's some of the earliest manuscripts are divided.
So it's written differently in the Greek.
There's, you know, one of the oldest manuscripts says it one way, one of the other old manuscripts says it the other, and so then you're kind of left to figure out which one did the author of Hebrews actually write down with his own hand. And it's a little bit tough to figure out, but I think
what's the other alternative? Maybe I just missed it here. But
well, I think even your NASB footnote has a footnote number 2. They were instead of it was right after the because. It's either it was not united or they were not united.
So they were not united by faith in those who heard.
Well, you have to change it slightly, but basically yes.
That doesn't even make sense.
Right. So that's why it would be they were not united with faith. They were not united in faith with those who heard. In other words,
there's two separate peoples.
Exactly. Okay. Which is why one of the commentators said all the textual critics land on that one, but all the exegetes land on the other one because it's such a hard reading. But it's the better supported reading. In other words, the NASB went with what's easier to understand, but weaker textual support. Anyway, it's a tough one. I'm not going to get too much into it because we could spend a lot of time debating all that.
Oh, so. Never mind.
But basically, is it the people that are being united with faith, or is it? Or in faith, or is it the message and faith that are being united? It's either the people or the message that are being united.
Okay, in other words, the people are united by faith, not the message.
Right. Then the way NASB has it, it's message and faith united. And that makes sense. Everyone can, I think, pretty much grasp that. The harder one would probably be saying that the people who heard the message were not united together with, and then this is where it gets tricky, those who heard, which would probably be like Moses or the good spies or the people that had told the message to them.
There's a division in the camp, so to speak.
Right, exactly.
Those who heard and didn't, and those who heard and didn't.
Right, so I would probably... Does anyone have ESV?
Yeah.
Read how ESV does it, because they take the other position.
Because they were not united by faith with those who listened.
See, so that's, they were not united by faith with those who listened.
So it doesn't, in one sense it drastically changes, in one sense it doesn't, because the emphasis is still on
faith.
Faith.
Yep.
The question is whether there's a division between the people or whether the people received the message and mixed it together.
I think where the NASB landed makes a lot more sense.
Well, it seems like it'd be true either way.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
What does NASB say?
It says, because it was not united by faith in those who heard. And I would do, it was not united with faith, probably even better than by faith.
The question is just whether you're talking about a separation between people,
mm-hmm.
or...
separation between the message and faith.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
I mean, you almost get to the same place either way, but it does change a little bit the emphasis of the passage.
Right. Although faith still, without a doubt, is the emphasis. And so you go, the parallel is clear, right? We have heard just as they have heard. We've heard the good news. And the question is, what do you do with the good news? And the obvious answer is, you believe, right? You don't disbelieve. And once again, that's why faith is at the center of this. And it's confirmed as you go to verse 3, for we who have believed. enter that rest, right? Belief is what is necessary to enter into the rest, and literally it's our entering that rest. If we are believing, we are entering the rest. That's what is necessary to enter into this rest. Okay? And so, once again, faith, believing, is at the heart of appropriating God's promises. It's like the Israelites, right? They knew that God promised that if they entered Canaan, they were going to defeat the giants. But they didn't believe it, and so therefore they disobeyed. Disobedience flows out of disbelief, right? They didn't go in because they didn't believe that God would allow them to conquer. And so he is saying, and that's why I say, we who are believing are entering. Once again, yes, he's warning of them of the danger, but at the same time, he's encouraging them, right? We are entering it. You know, if we're believing, we who are believing are entering. And so he's kind of grouping them in and saying, we're going into the promised rest. And so it's a warning, but yet at the same time, it's not a denunciation or rebuke against them necessarily. And so just as he said, and now he's going to pick up Psalm 95 again. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. And then this phrase, although his works were finished from the foundation of the world. Now, as you first read this verse, this quote in verse 3, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. At first, you might be tempted to think where he's going with this is where he went in chapter 3, i.e. warning. But that's not really what he's going to be going from. What he's going to be doing here is drawing some implications from this. And this is really crucial to keep in mind. He's quoting Psalm 95, which was written hundreds of years later after the Exodus generation. And remember, the author of Psalm 95 starts off with, "Today if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts." And it's a warning to the psalmist's own day that to enter into God's rest. And so he says, look, basically what the author is saying, look, this is what God said. He swore that they shall not enter my rest. Now, one of the significant things about this is what? That little phrase, my rest. Who's the my? Who swore? God, right? And so what is my rest? Who has rest then? God has rest, okay? And he's going to develop this simple concept that God has been resting, God has a rest, and he swore that people shouldn't enter into his rest. Now remember, this is in Psalm 95, and the author of Psalm 95 is encouraging his readers not to harden their hearts, lest what? Lest by implication, they don't enter into that rest. And so what the author of Hebrews is going to show, and I'm kind of stealing his thunder a little bit because he's going to develop it, but what he's going to show is if the author of Psalms, if the psalmist could say, warn the hearers about not entering into his rest, then that rest is still open. And that's this whole idea of remaining, verse 1, right? The promise remains. And really, his whole argumentation is moving up to verse 9, so there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. That's where he's moving in this whole argumentation. He starts off with a warning, verses 1 and 2, but then he moves to argumentation to show that the promise is still open. It's still remaining, and we can enter into it. And so that's what he's going to do here, is to argue this. And so this phrase here, although his works were finished from the foundation of the world, this is how you could almost summarize this verse. God excluded the wilderness generation from his place of rest, and yet it had always been there, available for someone. You with me? Verse 3 says, as I swore my rest, they shall not swore my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. In other words, he's saying here, look, God forbid these people to enter his rest. But then he says, although his works were finished from the creation of the world, he forbid them from entering his rest, yet that rest had always been there. You see, that's kind of the emphasis, I think, of this. Like, he says, you know, what does it mean his works were finished from the foundation of the world? It means he's been resting since the beginning, right? Since day 6, God has been resting, and yet he forbid people from entering his rest. His rest had always been there, and yet God forbade people from entering. Okay, and he's gonna, let me just keep walking with this, because I think as you keep following his logic, it will make more sense. For he has said somewhere concerning the seventh day, and now he quotes Genesis 2, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. So now he goes back even farther, all the way back to Genesis 2, passage we all know well, what happened? God created the universe in 6 days, and then he rested. So in other words, the rest has gone, goes back a long ways. It goes all the way back to the beginning of creation. Okay? And again, this passage, and he quotes it once again, they shall not enter my rest. Okay, now, this is what's significant is in Psalm 95, he's warning them about not entering my rest, the author of Psalms. And so the logic is God has been resting since creation. Then there's this whole Exodus generation, the promise of entering the promised land, the land of rest. And God swore to them that they wouldn't enter into that rest that he's had from the beginning, right? It wasn't a new kind of a rest. It was a rest from the beginning, and they couldn't enter into that rest. Okay, then Psalm 95 comes along, and the author of the psalm later in time says, warns his hearers to basically enter into that rest. Don't have a hardened heart so that you won't enter his rest. And so the implication is God has a rest. Right, God has been resting from the beginning. This rest is open for people to enter, apparently, right? Because the wilderness generation wasn't able to enter into that rest. And then the psalmist even warns his people about not entering that rest. So what does that imply? If no, the rest is still open. It's still available. It's still there. And so that's what he says in verse 6. Therefore, since it remains, once again, that key word remains, for some to enter into it, and those who formerly had good news preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience, he again fixes a certain day today, saying through David, after so long a time, just as has been said before, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. So hopefully, those three verses are, it's hard to track the logic, but hopefully, given that little bit of an introduction, you could trace with it, right? It remains, that's his whole point. That rest remains open. Because, look, the wilderness generation, they had the good news, but they didn't fulfill that rest, right? How could they have? They didn't enter into that rest, right? God forbade them from entering into the promised land. They failed to enter because of disobedience. And so, therefore, the idea is God promised this rest. They didn't fulfill it. They didn't kind of use up the rest, if you will. The promise wasn't fulfilled in them, so it's still open. It's still available. It still remains.
The rest that God forbade them to enter in is the promised land?
Yes, and that's where it gets a little bit tricky because obviously, you go back to Exodus, and the rest is the promised land. But I think the author of Psalms and the author of Hebrews says it's beyond that, right?
Okay, I was going to say, or is there more to it?
Yeah, there's
the implication. Yeah. Not only that was their physical rest, but they also missed the spiritual.
I think so. Because that's why he goes back to creation, right?
Right.
God has been resting from the beginning, and God himself has had a rest. And you know, we'll develop this as we go a little bit. But yes, I think you're correct in saying the author of Hebrews is going beyond just the Canaan rest. He's kind of giving them as an example. But they don't, there's more to it than that. And I think we'll see it as we go through.
I'd never thought of the fact that God has been resting from that day. I'm not sure I'd necessarily even given it consideration.
Right.
But to play off that, that's what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
He rested on the seventh day, and he's been resting ever since.
Right, because they shall not enter my rest. God has a rest. You know, that's in Psalm 95. God has this rest that they shall not enter into. And so that's why he says in verse 3, although his works were finished from the foundation of the world. In other words, God was done. And I don't mean that God does nothing, but there's a sense in which God has been resting. Does that make sense? All right. So if you go to verse 6 then, it remains for some to enter it, right? Because the wilderness generation, didn't go in. They didn't fulfill it. They didn't enter into that rest. And so God had a rest, and so they didn't fulfill it, so it's still open for someone to enter in, right? They had the good news preached, but they failed because of disbelief. And then verse 7, this is where he's going back to the psalm. He again fixes a certain day today, right? That's the psalmist. That's Psalm 95. Remember, that's how Psalm 95 starts off. Today. And notice this, saying through David, after so long a time. In other words, they failed to enter. Hundreds of years later, David says, today, right? And so, in other words, David is then, depending on, the psalm is anonymous, so it's unclear whether it's, you know, when he says David, just to refer to the psalms in general, or to David as the author of this psalm. That's ambiguous. It's not really that important. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. Why? Because implication, that rest is still open. And then once again, verse 8, for if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. And the other day after that is in the psalm. Does that make sense? The psalmist wouldn't have said, you know, do not harden your hearts by implication, lest you enter into that rest, unless that rest was still open, unless that rest was still available. And so then he concludes it all with verse 9, so there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God.
So basically, his point is verse 9.
Yeah, his point without a doubt is verse 9.
Even if you don't understand all the logic of it all, the point is still there. There is a rest. And yeah. He's been trying to prove
exactly. That
rest has existed all along.
Yeah. And so that's what the promise is. The promise is the promise of rest. And so, obviously, he's writing to New Testament believers. The application for us is there's a rest. And you say, what is that rest? I mean, he doesn't really define it, but as you start to think about, I mean, would you say the kingdom? Maybe. Would you? I would probably say, I just start to think about, okay, he even uses, it's Sabbath. He throws he coins this term. It's not found in the Septuagint. It's not found anywhere else. It's based off of the verb Sabbath. But it's this new word Sabbath. And so he's tying it in with the Sabbath, this rest that we have as believers. Obviously, this book is so eschatological. The promises, the faith, the things that we hold on to are eschatological. I think you absolutely have to say that this rest is something that happens after we die, right? It's the promise hope that we have. And I just start to meditate on what is this rest? What is God's rest? What was the Sabbath supposed to be? And the more I started to meditate on what the Sabbath was supposed to be, it was supposed to be a time of worshiping God, of reflecting on Him, of putting aside the toil and the trouble of life and just resting and worshiping Him. And that really is what heaven's all about. Now, I mean, I don't want to get it. I don't think he overly defines it, the kingdom about too, if you will. But at this point, he doesn't really define it. You'd say that the same about both, is that it's fellowship with God. It's rest from our work and our labor and our toil and our troubles. That's the rest that heaven is. And that's the rest that the Sabbath, in part, I would say from the author of Hebrews, is meant to picture, is meant to be a little foretaste of. And I even passage in Hosea. I'm interesting. Let's go to Hosea just briefly, just to kind of, as I just kind of meditated on what is the Sabbath, what is rest all about. Go to Hosea chapter 2. Just briefly, start in verse 8. If you know Hosea, this is where God is condemning Israel for their rebellion and their idolatry against him. And so he's talking about, look at verse 8, for she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the new wine, and the oil, and lavished on her silver and gold. In other words, Yahweh, he's picturing himself as a husband here, if you know the book of Hosea. He lavished on his wife Israel all these are good things, right? Grain, new wine, oil, silver and gold. These are not bad things that he had given to her, right? They're good things that he had given to her, but she attributed them all, end of verse 8, to Baal, right? She used for Baal. She attributed to Baal. And so what is he going to do? Therefore, I'm going to take back my grain and my new wine, my wool, my flax. Right? God gave her all these good things, and now he's going to take them away because they were rebellious and idolatrous against him. And he's going to uncover her lewdness. Notice this, I will also put an end to all her gaiety, her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her festal assemblies. I would say, just in the context, those seem to be good things that God had given to Israel, which he's going to take away from her because she had used them for idolatry. Okay, but you look at that list. These are happy things for gaiety, right? Rejoicing. And then you look at feasts, new moons, and Sabbaths, and festal assemblies. They're just all listed together. The feasts are a good picture for me, right? You go to Jerusalem, you sacrifice, you celebrate, whether it be the Passover or whatever, you worship God in celebration. But at least in my mind, when I hear Sabbath, I think somber, solemn, kind of like, I don't know, morose, boring, yeah, kind of a thing. But at least in this list, right, Sabbaths were good. They were supposed to be a time of rejoicing in God. They were supposed to be a time of meditating on him and putting aside the toil and trouble of life.
Do you think the word celebration, or do we shy away from the word celebration?
No, I that's kind of what I'm getting at. And I don't want
to... Because I think worship can be celebration.
Right. It's thankfulness to God. It's rejoicing in him for all that he's done. And so I don't want to draw too much out of, the parallel between these four terms of feasts, new moons, and Sabbaths, but it at least implies that the Sabbaths were a good thing. They were a time to meditate on God. I don't want to draw too much out of there, but...
I'm thinking of all the things that I could use to teach how to not read back in. Because when I think of Sabbath, you said something about when I think of Sabbath, so I started thinking about all the things when I think of Sabbath, which was always Sunday, right? Mm-hmm. It was like nap at 3 o'clock, you know.
That's rest.
Right, but the point you were making is that it is rest, but that's what I always think about it. But the point is we can't read that back in.
Right.
We think of it being kind of a down day.
Right.
But you're saying that it's more of a day of
celebration. And I'm not saying it's necessarily wasn't a somber time. We don't have a whole lot of information in terms of, in one sense, what you were to be doing on the Sabbath. In one sense.
Well, Pharisees defined it.
Right.
So, but we've had a history in the church of making Sunday, which is our Sabbath, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Right.
That's a whole nother discussion, which we can maybe talk about. But let me put it on pause for now.
Off the record.
Maybe application-wise, I would say, we could learn some things about the Sabbath, but I would not say that Sunday is a Sabbath.
So if he's making the point here, there's
no,
a Sabbath.
No, I said our
rest.
Sabbath. I didn't say the Sabbath.
Yeah, but I wouldn't use that term.
Well, isn't that the day we've set aside for worship?
Yeah, but as soon as you use the word Sabbath, you start bringing in all the Old Testament laws and regulations regulating the Sabbath.
Well,
otherwise,
what I wanted to say was the... Let me say, American church has put a lot of legalistic things on top of our Sundays.
Right.
Which I think subconsciously we consider the Sabbath.
Right.
In our culture. Mm-hmm. Okay? And that is where the negative side comes in, I think, culturally.
Right.
And that's why when we talk about, we think of legalistic, you can't do this and you can't do that on Sunday. I mean, I grew up where we weren't allowed to read Sunday comics until after lunch. Now, whether that was a practical side because there were so many of us, and they would be yeah, but we didn't go to the movies. But, I mean, those kinds of things, I think, get superimposed on our image of these words.
Right.
When we read them, and we carry that baggage with us.
Yeah, and we do need to be careful about that. But just to get back to the point of what this is about, it's about rest. And this is obviously, he's using the Sabbath as a picture for the future, right? For eschatological, our being with God. And that's why I say the parallel is our worship of him, our rest from our toil and our trouble. You think about just even the kingdom, for example, what it's going to be characterized by. It's not going to be, You know, the curse is virtually going to be removed.
It's a cessation from work.
Right.
Which is defined by
work
all
or toil.
That we do now, right?
Right.
Not necessarily work in the sense of going to work, but work in the sense of the labor that God has given to us now that is always resistant.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, and I would say that it seems to... I mean, you're right, I think. So much of our life now is consumed with fighting the curse.
Well, isn't even, you know, even the point with the people there, when they're entering into the land, he's saying it's a good land.
Right.
It's a prosperous land. Land flowing with milk and honey. But they wouldn't enter into that rest. It wasn't that they wouldn't ever do anything once they got into the land, but they wouldn't enter into it because, by faith, because they saw the obstacles, right?
Yeah. But I think here where he's going, though, is, in my mind, it's very eschatological, this rest that he's talking about. And it's related just the idea of time to be free from work and toil and trouble and just time to meditate on God. And it, to me, it does seem to be just what eternity is all about in one sense, just the worship of God, free from all the cares of life, if you will.
But he's not inherently defining it. He's just
right,
saying
exactly.
That we need to push on into it.
Right, exactly.
Just like he didn't say, let me give you the 28 reasons why you ought to press into the promised land. He just tells them it's a good land, right?
Right. But then he not that he defines, but then even verse 10, for the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works as God did from his. And the idea is, if you enter into God's rest, you're going to be resting as God is resting. And that's, I think it, more than just saying you need to enter into that rest, there is a hope of entering into that rest. And this is a good rest that we can enter into. And so I think it's a little bit, I think it is helpful to think about what is really the characteristic. I mean, yes, you're right, he doesn't define it, and I don't want to over-define it, but at least to give some sort of a, this is something hopeful. This is a promise. This is good. This is something that we're looking forward to and resting from our, at a very minimum, resting from our labors and toils. And I think of just some of the idea that he had of what the Sabbath was. It was very, this is a very positive thing that we're going to enter into this Sabbath rest. And that's why I said I would even kind of bring in some of those positive connotations of things like worship of God and just because of his use of the word Sabbath rest, rather than just keeping it with the word rest, he inserts that other word, I think, to maybe bring in some of those good ideas of just what eternity will be like, in essence, and what a great promise it is that we can enter into that.
Whatever it is, it's good. We're not there yet, and if we press on in faith, it'll be good.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And the point you're just making right now is somewhat what I said this morning, right? When you hear the time has been fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand, it's almost a fearful thing. And yet Mark describes that as good news.
Right.
And what this is so good that we should press in on into it.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, as you said, even if you don't get the logic of how he gets there, which is a little bit difficult, but I think I understand the logic of it, the point is very clear. He's arguing to say the Sabbath rest remains for the people of God. We can enter into that rest. And he does it on the basis of the... Basically, he just follows in the footsteps of the psalmist who did the very same thing for his readers. And he's like, if the... I would say his logic is basically like this. If the psalmist can say to his generation, press, you know, don't harden your heart so that you can enter into the rest, then I could say to my generation, don't harden your hearts, but keep on believing so that you can enter into his rest. And don't miss the point that it all comes down to faith, right? We who are believing are entering into that rest. But their problem was there was no blending with faith. You know, there has to be the faith. Without the faith, we're going to come short of it. And there's, once again, unbelief leads to disobedience. You have to believe in order to obey. And so I think we'll end at verse 10. Verse 11, once again, just the exhortation, be diligent to enter that rest, right? So that no one will fail through following the same example of disobedience. And then he goes on to give a great explanation, an exhortation to support everything that he's just said. So once again, exhortation and warning, yeah. But yet very positive.
That's what I was just going to say. So really, verse 1 is kind of a somber warning mm-hmm. to fear. And verse 11 then comes kind of that positive exhortation to just, with all of your diligence, pursue after that rest.
Exactly. And once again, coming to keep reminding ourselves of where we're going, we've heard the word, right? We've had good news preached to us. We've seen that all throughout this book. God is speaking. God has said things. He has promised good things to us. How do we respond, right? Do we believe what he says and act on it, or do we disbelieve and disobey? And so that is the heart of this, is how do you respond to God's word? How do you respond to God's message? And it has to be, as you said, it's got to be a continual life of responding in faith. It's got to be a life of faith all the way to the end. And I've never seen so clearly that this book, Hebrews 11, isn't ancillary to this book. It's in a sense where he's moving all the way along. He's moving towards the need for faith to the end all throughout. And so we need to press on in faith. We need to hold fast and fear coming short.
So I'm still a little fuzzy on something, and maybe the answer is no. Have we defined what God rested from?
His works.
His works, yeah.
That's what I'm asking. Is it his creative works, or is it works in total?
Well,
it's tough because it depends on how you define what you're saying.
I mean, I think he goes to the seventh day in his argument, so it seems to be primarily creative works.
Oh, okay.
All right. You know, would I say, I mean, it kind of depends on how you look at it. Would I say God is active today? Of course.
Oh, God, well, yeah.
You know, but does that mean God is working? No, it's looking at a different aspect of God's work, I think. In one sense...
Yeah, it's not like he's up there twiddling his thumbs.
Right.
And has no active interest in man or active right. involvement.
Right.
No, I didn't get that idea.
But there's a very real sense in which when he was done with creation, his work was done. And I just can't overdefine it than that.
Right. Well, that's what I wanted to make sure that you weren't saying there was more to it than the creative works.
No, I think primarily it's the creative works.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because some of his work maybe was not what we would say done, but it was settled in eternity past because
right.
he knew.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think you could almost tie so much of what you're talking about into the creative works in that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, it's not really the point of the text. Theologically, could you say that? I think you could. Anyway, kind of a interesting passage to work through the logic, but I hope that the basic flow of it makes sense, you know, and it as we have pointed out before, it flows right out of Scripture, right? He's so much just dealing with what Scripture says, and you know, God has spoken, and so how do we respond? And God has spoken in Scripture. All right, well, let's go to the Lord in prayer. Our Father, as we do turn to this passage, we do just thank you for the great promises that you have given us. Lord, you have given us so many promises of eternity with you and just the gospel that we have heard. We do pray, O Lord, that we would be those who are believing, Lord, your promises and appropriating them by faith and living in light of them, looking forward to the rest that we will someday have with you. We know that we have toil and trouble here on this life, but we know that if we pursue and we make it to the end, we hold fast until the end, that we will be those who receive your great promises. And so we thank you and we praise you for that. In Christ's name, amen.